does in Singing in the Rain has proved impossible to emulate.
I can't tell you how many times I've tried. Yeah, make him laugh.
When stage productions of this are done, no, they really can't find people who can do that. It's a dead skill in many ways.
Matthew, we will talk more later about the shape of the second half of tonight's concert. Meanwhile, though, thanks very much indeed. Now, though, it's time for another snapshot from our Proms Lates, the weekly post-proms gigs that we've been staging here at the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room, featuring poetry and music from up-and-coming young artists. Tonight, we're going to hear traditional Scottish music from the pianist Suzanne Houston, violinist Kristen Harvey. Before that, let's hear from poet Paul Batchelor introducing his own work.
This last poem is an ode, an address to a harver, and a harver is a half brick. O harver, O haffer, O half brick, your battened down century of faithful service in a pit village terrace, forgotten now, you've broken loose. Now you're at large on CCTV, flackering out of kilter till you bounce like far-flung hail rebounding off the riot squad, or kissing the away support a fond goodbye, or anyhow let fly as 50 years ago someone aimed you at my father's skull while he was being shepherded down Rutherglen Road, when it was raining bottles, when it was raining hammers and nails after an old firm fixture, the decider. I exist because you missed and broke his collarbone. I weigh you now against the good you've done. St. George's Hill, when Cromwell's cavalry advance, we find you or your country cousins apt and good, versatile in the hands of the true levellers. Now Banksy has a laugh replacing you with flowers. And what about that your bit part in that dockyard standoff? The gates swing to, the scabs clock on. As to the nitty-gritty of whose side you're on, you stay, as they say, ahead of the curve. But you were there at Peterloo, and you were there at Brixton. You were all the rage in Meadowell. Your ancestors were with us in the cave before the wheel, before the fire. And ever since, we've never been without you. All our grand designs can be reduced to you. You stand for stunted hope grown wild among the backyard odds and sods, where the snubbed toaster and the jilted BMX jockey for position with the unacknowledged honesty. O root and seed of boxed-in lives, O token of descent. How often have I seen you in the thick of it and raised my arm against you? On pitted tarmac by the gutted community centres of besieged estates, born as a gift or hurled down like a prophecy, I've seen you taken up and even in the playground, hidden in a snowball, you followed hard upon. You've come a long way from the clay pit, worked out and abandoned, a long way from the vanished kilns of Langley and Eldon. Here, let me launch you on another posthumous career, earthbound comet, stub of destiny, throwback. I have a soft spot for you, so go on, make something happen. O clod, O totem of the unaccommodated, O harver, history's ellipsis point, sign to which we must attend. When words fail, may you always be at hand. Thank you for listening.
Thanks very much indeed. Just now we'll do a medley of tunes. The first I wrote for my granny right up in the north of the Highlands. It's called Wee Granny's Waltz. And then I'll go into a tune that I wrote actually for my sister's dance team. This tune is called Gurr for Gursach, and the dance troupe's called Gursach. So we'll see you again in a wee while. Thank you.
two of Suzanne Harvey's original numbers, Gur for Gursach, and before that, Wee Granny's Waltz, Suzanne Houston piano, Kristen Harvey violin. Earlier we heard the poet Paul Batchelor reading Ode to a Harvard. Very warm welcome back to the Proms from me, Susie Klein. We're live at the Royal Albert Hall. Time for a very quick look ahead at some of the Proms highlights over the coming days. September is indeed about to arrive, which means it is time for some of the big guns, the foreign orchestras who traditionally visit the Proms in the run-up to the last night. So in the next week or so, the Netherlands Radio Orchestra, the Israel Phil, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia Orchestras, and the Budapest Festival Orchestra, which has not one but two Proms with its music director Ivan Fischer, first Liszt and Mahler, then a late night concert. It's an audience choice Prom. That's a Prom's first. The first time we've done that this year, where the crowd here gets to pick the music from the orchestra's huge repertoire. There's apparently going to be a tuba roving the Albert Hall aisles, stuffed bears in the arena, and one very busy and mildly stressed orchestral librarian, plus a three-piece gypsy band. It sounds great. That's going to be this coming Friday, so do tune in for that. Meanwhile, here at the Royal Albert Hall this evening, it's Hooray for Hollywood, and listening with me this evening, Matthew Sweet. Let's look ahead to the remainder of the concert. We've had Fred and Ginger, we've had Wartime Hollywood, we've had Fred Astaire's Swan Song. Where do we go to next?
Well, we go first to the 50s, where MGM is really the dominant figure in the Hollywood landscape. RKO and Warner Brothers aren't so interested in musicals at this point. In fact, they've sort of been outdone. MGM is a giant juggernaut. It has a man called Arthur Freed working on its musical pictures. And he creates, well, it's much disputed really whether really was what was known as the Freed unit.
Yes, what is the legendary Freed unit?
Well, the Freed unit was this kind of, if you believe the mythologists, it was this sort of this crack unit of people who produced musicals in the most kind of intense and worked way. Actually, the people who actually worked there say it was something of a looser coalition than that. But anyway, from the outside, it looked like the most brilliant machine that produced musicals of great intensity, of great luxuriousness, and of great musical sophistication.
But what we also get in the second half of this concert is the move into the 50s, into the demise of the studio system in the 60s. As musicals get a bit more sexy, there's more about race politics, gender politics, there's a darker side to the musical,
well,
certainly.
Things begin to loosen up, and subjects that would have been untreatable during the days when legislation like the Hays Code was really enforced become possible. The studios start to wobble and begin a long, slow process of decline. That really seals the fate for the musical. And really, you can see the fate of the musical as being really a kind of exemplum of a decline in the studio system generally, because people just don't have the resources to stage these kind of spectacles, and they become increasingly kind of high-stakes enterprises.
And also deeply unfashionable. For many decades, the musical fell out of fashion, aging stars, plots that were seen as cheesy, that seemed off-kilter, I suppose, with the wider appetite for youth-led popular counterculture. Well, earlier today, Louise Fryer caught up with tonight's conductor, John Wilson, at one of our Proms Plus events over the road at the Royal College of Music, where they talked about John's painstaking reconstructions of some of the lost gems of the Hollywood musicals.
I have to do very little altering of the score because I want to give the score exactly as you hear it in the movies to the second oboe. You know, it's exactly the same. What you have to do is find out if the music exists. Different studios have different attitudes towards preserving their music libraries. MGM, as everybody knows, destroyed the lot. Warner Brothers kept everything. Fox have most of it. Paramount have some of it, you know. And then, so the stuff, MGM stuff we're doing tonight, I had to do myself, or one of my colleagues helped me with that.
So does that mean actually watching the film and
listening to the soundtrack and transcribing it? The world's most boring activity. But then Warner Brothers have been great. They send me scores and say, this is the original score. You then look at the score and listen to the film and look at what changes were made. Often they change a lot because they had lots of time to record these things, so they change a lot. So then you incorporate those changes into the final edition. I mean, but even a concert like tonight is a year's work. It's an enormous undertaking. And the best illustration I have, to give you an idea how much time and effort it takes to put a concert like this together, the physical labour, is the cost of the sellotape to put the parts together. To sellotape the scores and the parts for the orchestra together came to £1,600. That's the sheer Labour.
John Wilson on the joys of using much sellotape there. Matthew Sweet, this prom apparently sold out in 4 hours. Why are musicals back on the map again?
Well, I think because everybody went to see Mamma Mia, didn't they? And realised the possibilities of the form. Mamma Mia, quite a cheap little film, really. But still, you know, something of the resonance and the fun of the films that we're celebrating tonight.
And also you think of things like Rocky Horror and Moulin Rouge. Even of the forthcoming films, apparently Clint Eastwood's going to be directing Beyoncé in A Star Is Born. They're remaking it. So there is
yet
a future
again
of some sort in
Absolutely,
the musical.
Yes, well, Star Is Born has been remade, you know, once every few decades. It's one of those to which we endlessly return.
Great, Matthew, thanks ever so much. So on we go with the second half of tonight's Hooray for Hollywood Prom. Joining the players of his orchestra on stage, it's John Wilson.
Smoke up this line I'm handing you is not a handout. Lost their glitter, winds grow colder and suddenly older, and all because of the man that got away. burn out tomorrow, you might turn. There's just no let up. Live long night and
Caroline O'Connor, the vocalist there, with Matthew Little and Stephen Dowse appearing from the Maid of Ale Singers, and music from Judy Garland's comeback, A Star Is Born. Next, it's more from the Fabulous 50s as Claire Teal comes on stage. Doris Day's most famous number from Calamity Jane, Secret Love, sung by Claire Teal. Going off stage now to be replaced by Charles Castronovo and music by Zygmunt Romberg. From MGM's 1954 musical The Student Prince, that was Serenade. That song sung in the movie by Mario Lanza, and here at the Proms tonight by Charles Castronovo with the Maida Vale Singers. Next up, it's more music by Gershwin from the movie Funny Face. It's Clap Your Hands.
Found you if he has found. down, you children, but you can chase that hoodoo with the dance that you do. Let us lead the way, Jubilee today. He'll have a hand to stamp on the ground, you children. Clap your hands, slap your thighs, hallelujah, hallelujah. Everybody come along and join the jubilee. Clap your hands, slap your thighs, don't you lose time, don't you lose time. Come along and shake your shoes, time now for you and me. Santa through the devil, clap your hands, slap your thighs. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Everybody come along and join the jubilee. So ring them bells, ring them bells out. Ring them, ring them, ring them, ring them. Hey! Well, Mr. Matthew, how we do?
Well, Miss Claire, we two of the most friendly vibrations you ever did see.
Hey, diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle.
The dish ran away with the spoon. Well, Miss Claire.
Uh-huh.
Do you know why the chicken crossed the road?
No, why does a chicken cross the road?
Well, to get to the second floor, woman.
Oh, man, you're a genius. Roses are red, the violets are blue.
The dresses has got to be shown. So
let's get this show on the road. Boy, beat, boy, give me that, give me that, give me that, give me that crazy knocked out beat. You gotta spill a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, if you wanna get to the promised land. You gotta clap your hands.
Ford and Claire Teal, the vocalists there, with the John Wilson Orchestra, music from Funny Face. Now, many of the 1960s most successful musicals drawn from Broadway, including this. We'll be right back. final climactic flare there from the principal trumpet of the John Wilson Orchestra, Michael Lovett. The overture to Julie Stein, Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence's musical Gypsy, made into a Warner Brothers film in 1964. Next up, another Sondheim collaboration. It's music by Leonard Bernstein from West Side Story.
Thank you.
from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, made into a movie by United Artists, 1961. One Hand, One Heart, Sarah Fox and Charles Castronovo. Next, Annalene Beechey is back. It's music by Meredith Wilson from The Music Man. This is Being in Love. A Dream of Perfect Love from Meredith Wilson's The Music Man. That was Being in Love, sung by Annalene Beechey. Well, next this evening, you can expect a few laughs now when our soloists walk on next. If you know the song Triplets, you'll know why.
Children simultaneously. The doctor brought us and he can see that we'll be three forever and a.
I hope
you would know how agonizing being true can be. Each one is individually the victim of their little day.
I hope
every summer we go away to Baden, Baden, Baden. Every winter we come back home to Walla, Walla, Walla. We do everything alike, we look alike, we dress alike, we walk alike, we talk alike, and what is more, we hate each other very much. We hate our folks, we're sick of jokes on what an art it is to tell us apart.
One of us gets the measles,
another one gets the measles,
then all of us gets the measles, and mumps, and croup. How I wish I had a gun, a little gun. It would be fun to shoot the other two and be only one.
Mrs. Wifflepuffer loves to talk to Mrs. Hildendorfer of the fatal natal day she had her silly willy.
Mrs. Hassenpuffer loves to talk to Mrs. Goldenwasser of her major operation when she had her twins.
But when Mother comes along, she silences the others. She accomplished something that is very rare in mothers.
MGM has got a Leo, but Mama has got a trio. She is proud but says three is a crowd.
Oh!
Dress alike, we walk alike, we talk alike, and what is more, we hate each other very much. We hate our folks, we're sick of jokes on what an art it is to tell us apart. We eat the same kind of victuals, we drink the same kind of bottles, we sit the same kind of high chair, high chair, high chair.
Sarah Fox, Matthew Ford and Caroline O'Connor dressed as three giant babies, bonnets, booties, teddy bears and all, fighting it out as the triplets from the Bandwagon. Well, next this evening, we're on to a glorious score. It's Frank Lesser's Guys and Dolls.
I dreamed last night I got on the boat to heaven, and by some chance I have brought my dice along, and there I stood, and I hollered, "Someone feed me!" But the passengers, they knew right from wrong. For the people all said, "Sit down, sit down, you're rocking the boat." People all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat." And the devil will drag you under with a sharp lapel of your cuff and coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down. I sailed away on that little boat to heaven, and by some chance found a bottle in my fist, and there I stood, nicely passing out the whiskey, but the passengers were bound to resist. For the people all said, "Beware, you're on a heavenly
trip."
Said beware, beware, you'll scuttle the ship. And the devil will drag you under with your fancy tie on your witch's neck. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down. And as I laughed at those passengers to heaven, a great big wave. Thank you.
Nigel Richards cooking up a storm here in the Royal Albert Hall, along with the Maid of Ale Singers. Sit down, you're rocking the boat from Frank Lesser's Guys and Dolls. Well, finally this evening, we are on to the last great flourish of the Hollywood studio system before it disappeared for good, and a trio of musicals from the 1960s.
Ain't it a glorious day, bright as a morning in May? I feel like I could fly.
None of your larking about.
Have you ever seen the grass so green or a bluer sky? Oh, it's a jolly holiday with Mary. Mary makes your heart so light.
You haven't changed a bit, have you?
When the day is grey and ordinary, Mary makes the sun shine bright.
Oh, honestly.
Oh, happiness is blooming all around her. The daffodils are smiling at the dove. When Mary holds your hand, you feel so grand. Your heart starts beating like a big brass band.
You are light-headed.
It's a jolly holiday with Mary. No wonder that it's Mary that we love.
Amici and Matthew Ford, the vocalists, with the Maid of Ale singers, and Jolly Holiday from the 1964 movie Mary Poppins, featuring, if I remember rightly, a group of singing and dancing penguin waiters. Next, the most romantic song ever sung to a seal.
When I look in your eyes, I see the wisdom of the world in your eyes. I see the sadness of a thousand goodbyes. When I look in your eyes, and it is no surprise to see the softness of the moon in your eyes, the gentle sparkle of the stars in the skies, when I look in your eyes. In your eyes, I see the deepness of the sea. I see the deepness of the love. Love, I feel you feel for me. Autumn comes, summer dies. I see the passing of the years in your eyes. And when we part, there'll be no tears, no goodbyes. I'll just look into those eyes, so wise, so warm, so real.
Isn't it a pity you're a seal?
Something in your eyes shows me the way and helps me to say the things that I could never say to you. Something in your voice sings to me. Something in your laugh makes me rejoice. And there is no choice except to let my thoughts all stray to you. Stray to you, they do. Something in you is rich and rare, and there is something more. Something in you is everything I've never known before. Something of your charm clings to me. Something of your warmth stayed in my heart and made me a part of you for just a little while. So think of me as something.
When I look in your eyes and something in your smile, from the movie starring Rex Harrison, Dr. Doolittle. Matthew Ford singing there with the John Wilson Orchestra. Next tonight, Barbara Streisand's arguably greatest musical triumph. It's music from Hello, Dolly.
world outside of Yonkers, way out there beyond this hick town, Barnaby. There's a slick town, Barnaby, out there, full of shine and full of sparkle. Close your eyes and see it glisten, Barnaby. Listen, Barnaby. Put on your Sunday clothes, there's lots of world out there. Get out your brilliantine and dime cigars. We're gonna find adventure in the evening air. Girls in white in a perfume night, where the lights are bright as the stars. Put on your Sunday clothes, we're gonna ride through town in one of those new horse-drawn open cars. We'll see the shows at Delmonico's, and we'll close the town in a whirl, and we won't come home until we've kissed a girl.
Put on your Sunday clothes when you feel down and out. Strut down the street and have your picture took. Dress like a dream, your spirits seem to turn about. That Sunday shine is a certain sign that you feel as fine as you look. Beneath your parasol, the world is all a smile that makes you feel brand new down to your toes.
Get out your feathers, your patent leathers, your beads and buckles and bows. For there's no good Monday in your Sunday.
Down the street and have your picture took.
Just like a dream, your spirits seem to turn about.
That Sunday shine is a certain sign that you feel as fine as you look.
Beneath your parasol, the world is all a smile. It makes you feel brand new down to your toes.
Thank you.
Barnstormer by Jerry Herman from the movie Hello Dolly. Put on your Sunday clothes, the final number in this celebration of the very best of the Hollywood musical from the John Wilson Orchestra. Full company of soloists joined there, by the way, by Stuart Matthew Price, a step-out singer from the Maida Vale Singers, who along with the members of the orchestra have just performed gloriously here this evening. John Wilson warmly shaking the hand of tonight's leader, Andrew Haveron, and the players of the orchestra on their feet now. They had such an astonishing reaction to their first MGM prom here back in 2009. John told me recently he was getting mail from that summer up until New Year's Eve. He would get letters almost every day from people who had loved that concert. Just the most phenomenal response to this music. Matthew, I think one thing that that does show is whatever fate befell the Hollywood musical, it was always a glorious place to immerse yourself.
It was indeed, and this is in a way the afterlife of all of these songs. They may have been consigned to the archive, but they still play in cinemas all over the world. And the songs really have lived tonight in this hall, haven't they?
And also they're discovered by a whole generation of people who never knew them the first time round. Important to say, these are young performers.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, and these, hopefully it also sends people back to the movies as well, so they can see the images that go with these songs too.
Chillicothe's and Paducah's with their bazookas to get their names up in lights.
All armed with photos from local rodos with their hair in ribbons and legs in tights.
Hooray for Hollywood! You have no way of knowing who'll make good.
Maybe you'll be another Papa Dion, your name in neon. If you get lucky, you could. Yes, buddy, you'll arrive if you can top his five. Hooray for Hollywood.
Hooray for Hollywood. That bully, wild and woolly Hollywood.
They hire cowboys and then hang their chaps up and doll their maps up and give them all that they lack. Now ain't it funny, they pay them money. Shows what you can do if your horse. Whose physiques are good, and then they tell them they're the perfect shape men to act like ape men, and then convince them they should.
They make them grunt and yell,
oh,
and people think they're swell.
Oh, 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 oh.
Matthew Ford, Claire Teal, Charles Castronovo and Sarah Fox. Tonight's great lineup of soloists. Leading the charge in Irving Berlin's There's No Business Like Show Business, raising the roof on the Royal Albert Hall, along with the Maid of Ale singers, their chorus master Christopher Dee, and the sensational players of the John Wilson Orchestra, led tonight by Andrew Haveron. Well, if you've enjoyed tonight's prom, you can watch it this Saturday night. Make it a date, 9 o'clock on BBC Two television. You can also, as always, listen again for the next 7 days via the Radio 3 iPlayer. We are back here at the proms, 7:30 tomorrow for a double proms debut. The French... Oh, do you know, I'm so excited, I've lost my notes. Jaap van Zweden. It's David Frey. I've found my notes. It's David Frey. Totally overwhelmed by this. Joined by the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra for Mozart's C Major Piano Concerto No. 12. Also on the bill, Bruckner's 8th Symphony. Meanwhile, I will compose myself as the rest of the Royal Albert Hall goes crazy for the John Wilson Orchestra. That's all for this evening. My thanks to Matthew Sweet for joining me. But for now, it's time to say goodnight from the Royal Albert Hall and hand you back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much to Susie Klein and her guest Matthew Sweet at the Royal Albert Hall. And as Susie said, that concert will be up on the website for you to listen to again, if you like, anytime over the next 7 days. Follow the links from the Radio 3 homepage. And our television colleagues, as she said, have been there recording it tonight. You can see it next Saturday night on BBC Two at 9:15. And just to clarify, tomorrow night's concert begins with Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 25 in C, played by David Frey. And Bruckner's 8th Symphony is after the interval. That's tomorrow at the proms, 7:30. Well, there is indeed no business like show business, and you may just possibly have noticed that tonight's extravaganza has lasted a little bit longer than we anticipated. So, apologies for keeping Norman Lebrecht and his guest in tonight's Lebrecht interview waiting. We'll be with them in just a moment, as soon as I've told you that I'm afraid we won't now be able to broadcast tonight's edition of The Essay, and that's so that we can bring you Jazz on 3 as advertised at 11 o'clock tonight. So now, at 10:08, we come to this week's edition of the Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Edward Gardner was 31 in 2006 when he became music director of English National Opera, and that was a huge risk on his part. The company, in crisis, had removed its chief executive and chief conductor, the latter before he arrived for work. One show after another was howled down in derision. The government talked of a merger with Covent Garden. The Arts Council threatened closure. The orchestra were on the verge of mutiny. It took either courage or a totally cocksure attitude for a young musician to walk into that maelstrom, eyes wide open. 5 years later, Gardner leads a company that wins awards for innovation and has set a trend in contemporary stagings. We'll soon find out how he helped turn it round. But life is never without setbacks, and in the thick of this season, Gardner found himself, unusually for a classical musician, at the centre of a tabloid feeding frenzy. The son of a psychologist and a nurse from Gloucester, he won a scholarship to Eton and went on to Cambridge. He cut his milk teeth at Glyndebourne Touring Opera, is about to become principal guest conductor in Birmingham, and is recording Britain's complete orchestral music for Chandos. This year, a signal honour, he'll conduct the last night of the proms, watched by millions the world over. Edward Gardner has truly arrived. Ed Gardner, your parents were both working doctors.
My father was a psychologist and my mother a nurse. They met in a hospital. My father's a music lover, but there was no great musician in my family at all, actually. My father's an amateur singer and sang in chorus at school and in choral societies after that, and had a passion for music. But my first sort of experiences with music were as a chorister in Gloucester Cathedral, which was my local great cathedral. And
were they hospital hours parents or were they hands-on parents?
Oh, incredibly hands-on. And my mother worked a long time on night duty in order that one of them was around for the three kids for a large percentage of the time.
And it was your father who took you to the cathedral?
A combination of the two. They really took it in turns. That ecclesiastical choral background was more of my father's world, but they were both very hands-on with it.
And so did it begin as a father-son thing, that you would go to the cathedral together, both to rehearsal and to sing?
Not really. Actually, we did sing together in a very small parish church near my home when I was just starting out, but after that he really... My older brother and I were both choristers there, and he left us to it.
Were you devout? Were you a religious family?
Not especially. I mean, going to church was a central part of our life. And my father's father was a Methodist minister, so it was very much in the blood of the family in that direction. And my mother's family era, Roman Catholicism is very strong. And it was very central going to church, actually. I mean, it turned into something different for me. It turned into a kind of the spirituality of music and what that might be was, I mean, looking back on it, was central to how I felt about music then and still do, I think.
It sounds almost as if, for you, the church is something separate from religion.
Yeah, it is actually, yes. I had a huge amount of experience of it up to my early 20s through school into Cambridge, where I sang for 3 years as well. And those extraordinary great works of art written mostly for the glory of God. But I just found the inherent drama and passion and devotion in them. And that's what really, really enthused me about music at that age.
Was there a point where you thought, I want to be doing this for the rest of my life? This is going to be the centre of it.
Yeah, I never thought I wouldn't, actually. I thought about conducting from sort of mid to late teens, but from very early on, when I was a chorister, I thought I was going to be a cathedral organist. You know, that was really all I thought about. And I was obsessed from an incredibly young age about Bach and Messiaen, and almost nothing in between on the organ, actually, which I mean, actually still sticks. I'm not sure about anything in between those two. And made my parents drive about 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning from Brittany to hear Messiaen play in Paris. It was August, he wasn't there, so yeah, I wasn't very popular for a little while after that. But I've never thought about doing anything else other than a life in music.
And was there any kind of crisis when your voice broke? Did you think?
No, not at all.
Because you were never going to be a singer?
I was never going to be a singer, and no, there was no crisis. I mean, I was no great treble, I was no great tenor, and I love singing in choirs. I love that collegial thing that great English church and cathedral choirs and chapel choirs have. No, it was a kind of fluke I went to Cambridge as a singer, to be honest. By that stage, I felt I could get into a better college singing than I could playing the organ, and I could spend more time conducting.
So the cathedral, King's School, and that won you a scholarship to Eton.
Mm.
Top hat, tails, striped trousers, the wall game. How did you fit into all of that? Your parents are working on the NHS.
Yeah, I mean, people have different experiences of it. And it's kind of a fluke which set of boys and teachers, you know, who's your housemaster is, how careful they are, you know, about looking after you, who your friends are, who's in your house. But I found it a very inclusive environment, and people were very respectful about talent, teachers and boys both. And the music education at Eton is completely extraordinary, and it's set in a wider, very academic context. It was great. I mean, this thing that people say about Etonians, that they're all extremely confident and feel that they can do, you know, they can achieve whatever they want to. And it can turn into a negative, but musically, the whole department under Ralph Allward, who's actually just about to leave, is geared to giving you confidence about doing what you want to do, which is actually, it's a wonderful outlook, especially at that age for me.
What's the whole system of public schools, isn't it, giving you confidence?
Yeah. I certainly wasn't overly confident at that age, and there were great, great musicians there at the same time, especially organists, people who could sight read anything and went on to organ scholarships at King's and Christchurch, Oxford, and I really felt a level under that, but the teachers were there to build you up, which is wonderful.
And then Cambridge.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of a disaster.
Oh, was it?
Well, wasn't it? You didn't like musicology.
No, I really didn't.
You didn't like theory of music.
I didn't like theory, no. And I regret having done an academic music degree, yeah.
Right.
I mean, actually, I've said that. I think the main problem is I didn't have enough knowledge of music. I didn't know enough music to understand really how it could be in any way relevant. What I really needed was someone to sit me down and say... I mean, Robin Holloway did this, to be fair. I mean, he was a wonderfully enthusiastic coach and teacher, and he would say, listen to these Sibelius symphonies, they're fantastic. You know, listen to them alongside an Elgar symphony or a Strauss tone poem and listen to the differences and the similarities. I found Schenkerian, all that stuff, I mean, interminable and just completely irrelevant. I mean, knowing what I do now and having gone into a career in music, I'd have loved to have studied languages or literature or something which would just widen my cultural base.
Mm.
I mean, I think I'm a bit hard on what musicology is. I'm sure there are people who've gone into the profession who have got a lot out of it, but just... For me at that time, it wasn't the right thing to have done.
Because you wanted to be hands-on.
Yeah, I wanted to be hands-on. I ended up spending most of my time conducting, really. So, I mean, it fitted well. I didn't have
college orchestra?
College orchestra, and we founded some friends and I founded an ensemble. We did big oratorios. We did four of the six parts of the Christmas Oratorio in King's Chapel and then the Creation afterwards as well.
And you were shuttling up and down to the Royal Academy at the same time?
At that stage, I was only visiting once or twice. I went to see Sir Colin Davis do a series of masterclasses. And he's such a great teacher and invests so much in it. And he used to do at least a masterclass a term, and I used to go down. And that's when I decided that being in that environment of the academy after Cambridge would be a really good idea.
So another year after Cambridge at the academy, was it? Or?
I did three more.
Three more?
Amazingly, yeah.
Right.
Those 3 years were incredibly important for me. And actually, that's when I learnt repertoire. And that's where I met so many wonderful, practical musicians who expressed themselves through what they did with their instruments or their voices. And from someone who's from a very specific education, I found it completely wonderful and eye-opening. And that was a great time. I'm incredibly fond of the Academy as an institution, actually.
And those people are now principals in major orchestras.
Those people are now principals in major orchestras, that's absolutely right. And they're soloists and they're people who come in and sing at ENO and sing around the world.
And then the first break was Salzburg, 1999.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
David Cyrus, who's the head of music at Covent Garden, was a wonderful supporter of mine at that time, and I used to go and watch rehearsal after rehearsal in Covent Garden. He went every summer to Salzburg, and I had done some small music courses in England over the previous summers, and I just wanted, rather than to be doing something like that, I wanted to experience a music making and a summer festival at the highest possible level. And I spoke to David about it, and he got me an invitation to watch rehearsals, watch Michael Gielen rehearse Lulu. And then one of the repetitors went sick, so I ended up playing for half the rehearsals. And after that, I spent three absolutely wonderful summers there working on the music staff.
And you worked with Gielen and John Elliott Gardner?
John Elliott Gardner. I chorus mastered for Mazal Savalich and Sylvain Cambreling as well.
Which
Trojans.
Opera? Right.
And then Figaro after that.
Right.
The Wernicke Trojans.
That was a big Trojans.
Yeah, that was the first full project I did there. And it was, to experience that piece, to be in, you know, in those beautiful surroundings and really rehearse something like that for 8 weeks with great singers was a huge privilege right at the beginning of my career.
It strikes me, looking at Eno's programming, that a large part of your repertoire tastes were formed in those late summers of Gérard Mortier's rule at Salzburg. Mm. Ligeti, Sarajevo, edgy, provocative,
yes, it's
productions.
True. Yes.
Big stuff like Trojans.
Yeah.
That was your education, wasn't it?
I've never analysed it, but I think there is something there. And if I think there's also that Fora del Spaus, Damnation of Faust, you're right.
Here we go again. Yes.
Yeah. The Trojans, yes. Yeah, absolutely. The Ligeti. Kaya's Amour de Loin, that's when I fell in love with the piece.
That was 2000, wasn't it?
That sounds right, yeah. I remember walking into a rehearsal in that Felsenreitschule, that wonderful sort of semi-open-air theatre, and hearing this sound world I'd never heard anything like before, and intoxicating, beautiful lyric, you know. Oh, yeah, and I was determined I'd do that one day, that piece.
Didn't quite work here, did it? It's a festival piece rather than an opera house piece.
The momentum of the piece is extremely slow. I found something magical about it because the director took it into a different world. I mean, I loved conducting it. I conducted another of her operas, Adriana Mater, with the BBC in concert. And you know what? Like Pelléas, they work equally well in concert because musically they create a wonderful world for themselves. And she's a unique composer. It was really important that we brought that to London, and it wasn't just a guest company doing it at the Barbican for one performance. It was a homegrown team putting together this great 20th, 21st century on the cusp piece.
It was a signal moment for ENO.
I think it was. And it
a statement of intent.
Yeah, and it came around a time when we were doing a peerless amount of 20th and 21st century work. The Ligeti was soon after that, yeah. Bluebeard's Castle. And as you can see from our next season, it's a tack we're going to stay on.
Back from Salzburg, Mark Elder gives you a job as his assistant in Manchester at the Hallé. Out of the blue?
Kind of, yeah. They've been looking for a while and I'd missed the audition, and he phoned up my conducting teacher from the academy and said, is there anyone there? And I went and auditioned for him on the last day that they had auditions. And it was magical 3 years. Musically, it was magical because the orchestra were incredibly confident about what they were doing. I mean, they still are, and so they just embraced me and allowed me to make my mistakes. And I hadn't done much symphonic conducting at that stage, and Mark was an extraordinary mentor, both about stuff in the Halle, and I mean, I've had a very similar career trajectory for him. He did lots for Glyndebourne before he went to ENO as well, and you know, we talk about all these jobs a lot. He's extremely helpful to me.
Were the players helpful in the Halle?
The Halle players were extraordinary, yeah. And they really helped me, and they forgot my mistakes, you know, much quicker than I did, and just you know, got on with making music. They were really wonderful. And actually, the management of that orchestra was so good. I mean, they set up a small panel of players who knew would give the right kind of constructive criticism about, you know, about what you'd done, how you'd rehearsed, how you performed. And it was great. I mean, it was, of course, those things are painful. It's a very brutal learning experience.
You would sit in front of a panel of players and they would tell you where you'd gone right and wrong?
We'd sit around and have a drink, and four or five people would have a cup of coffee, and we would just talk about what had been good and what hadn't, actually. I mean, I have to say it's testament to the, whatever you call it, course, fellowship, whatever it is, that they're still attracting very, very good young conductors. And we all go back to the orchestra. And actually, that's most orchestras end up completely loathing the people who've been their assistants. And it's much more collegiate between the assistant conductors and the orchestra there. It's a wonderful setup.
It's a delicate balance, though, between vulnerability and confidence, isn't it?
Mm.
Having
always,
to face
yeah.
the players afterwards. I mean, at the CBSO, where you're about to take yeah. over as principal guest, they have one of the most rigorous player grading systems for conductors
I didn't know that.
After
okay.
every concert,
wow.
players go and fill in forms what they think about
yeah.
the conductor.
Yeah.
How does that leave you as a conductor coping with the situation? It's a kind of perpetual exam. You're being marked.
Yeah, I don't really worry about that too much. I mean, you need to feel what the chemistry is with an orchestra easily enough, but you worry more about how the performance is, how you're going to put a great performance together. The CBSO, I mean, they have the energy of a chamber orchestra, but this brilliant sonority of a symphony orchestra, you know, with it. And I find their energy, I mean, wholesomely positive. I mean, it's really, really wonderful working with them.
And that's the other side of the equation. They have this kind of instantaneous combustion to
yeah.
use the chemical analogy.
Yeah.
And when they like someone, they like them instantly, and they
Maybe.
Embrace them as they did with Andres Nelson, as
yeah.
they have done with you.
Well, in a way, Andres, certainly I'm sure that's right, but I feel like we've built up a relationship over 4 or 5 years with the CBSO, and now it feels, you know, there's a huge amount of trust and certainly excitement from me when I go in there. And it's a wonder, yes, now what really is really wonderful.
Was it Mark who pushed you towards opera?
No, actually, I had already done a lot. I mean, I'd already done my Salzburg years. I've done a fair amount of ETO. I'd done a lot of assisting
mm-hmm.
at ENO and Covent Garden as well. But I did a lot of accompanying when I was at university and before and after. And it was always the slant of conducting I was more confident with at the beginning of my career. I always thought that would be my route into conducting.
Because you're more comfortable with voice? Because voice comes first?
It's something about having the emotional crux of the text to rely on. I remember when I was at university, I didn't really know how to do a Mozart symphony or how to do a Tchaikovsky symphony. But once I got to know Figaro or Onegin, it came much more easily to me. And it just felt, it's something about the dramatic slant of operas. It was my way in somehow.
Hmm. Glyndebourne touring opera, that's a pretty good learning curve.
Yeah, yeah.
You can afford to make mistakes at out-of-the-way places and
yeah,
get it right the next night.
Well, more than that, I mean, the rehearsal setup